Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, what is the difference between Hara Kabira and Hara Sgira, Djerba's two Jewish quarters? Last week we talked about the annual pilgrimage to La Griba Synagogue on the island of Djerba in Tunisia, which we attended as part of a group of international journalists invited by the Tunisian Ministry of Tourism. While we were there, we met Dr. Ruth F. Davis of Cambridge University. She's an ethnomusicologist who's done extensive research in mainland Tunisia and the island of Djerba, and she spoke with us about the history, legends, and customs of the Griba, and also about Djerba's Jewish community.
Thank you very much for doing this. Can you just introduce yourself, please? Give me your name and where you're from.
I'm Ruth Davis. I'm an ethnomusicologist at Cambridge University. And I've been involved with Tunisian music particularly, and also the music of Djerba for more than 30 years. And you want to know about something about the community here, the Jews from Djerba. Well, they're considered to be a very ancient community, one of the ancient Jewish communities of the Mediterranean diaspora. And according to their own legend, they came here after the destruction of the first temple in Jerusalem, the temple built by King Solomon. And what happened was that a group of priests, or Kohanim, from the temple managed to escape with some relics from the temple, including a door. And they carried these relics across the shore, across the Mediterranean littoral, and arrived eventually on the island of Djerba, and they found a secluded spot on the island, and they buried the relics and built the synagogue above the relics. And that is the origin of the Griba Synagogue and the community. And until quite recently, the inhabitants of the village Hara Sgira, meaning the smaller Jewish village, in Arabic, Hara is Jewish quarter, and Sgira means small. So, a small Jewish quarter. Till very recently, all the inhabitants were Kohanim. They were all called Kohen, after that legend. And of course, the Griba became a very holy synagogue because it was built on the foundations of the Jerusalem temple.
Well, this is, as you said, a legend. Has any archaeological work or been done to kind of prove that this is what really happened?
No. We don't know that. But it's not implausible that Jews were traveling around the Mediterranean, particularly for reasons of trade. In fact, we know that when King Solomon built his temple, he sent emissaries to other parts to get valuable materials, the cedars of Lebanon, for instance, you know, to find valuable materials with which to build the temple. And there were trade routes, and there was travel across the Mediterranean from very ancient time. Then, of course, there was the second diaspora after the destruction of the second temple by the Romans. And that was in the year 70 of the Christian era. And so it's very, very possible that Jews came. There was a massive dispersal at that time. So after the destruction of the second temple by the Romans, there was another massive dispersal. And then again, that the origin of many Mediterranean communities would have come from that time. Now, we do have archaeological remains from Roman times, which indicate that there was a Jewish community in Djerba. So we do know that they were there they've been there for a very long time, and certainly before the Muslim conquest, before the Arabs arrived on Djerba. So like the Berber community, which is also the indigenous community of the southern Mediterranean, the Jews are considered to be an indigenous community.
What can you tell us about the size of the community and special characteristics of the community, because they seem to be rather insular. Do they have a lot of contact or a lot of intercultural exchange with the surrounding Muslim community?
Well, there's a sort of a myth that the Djerba Jews were isolated, but in fact they were of course never isolated. Djerba itself has a port, Hunsuk. The very location of Tunisia in the center of the Mediterranean would indicate that it's unlikely to be an isolated spot. And yes, I mean, there was constant traffic across. Now, the Jews predominantly were traders. They were artisans also. They dealt with gold. Some were farmers, particularly in the smaller community, Harasfira. But in the larger community, Hara Kabira, they were predominantly artisans, traders, and of course scholars. So any one of those type of occupations would have put them into contact with the outside world.
When are you speaking about? Are you speaking about now, or are you speaking about hundreds of years ago?
I'm talking about traditionally for many centuries. And in fact, in the 18th century, Djerba became quite an important center of Jewish scholarship. There was a succession of very famous rabbis who attracted students, and they published. And also, at a certain point, I can't tell you exactly when, a printing press was established on the island for publishing in Hebrew. Another wave of immigration that came with the exodus from Al-Andalus, or from Spain, from Iberia. And the Jews that came from Spain mostly settled in Hara Kabira, in the larger village. And Hara Kabira has always had a different character from Hara Sphira. And Hara Sphira is traditionally the holier community, because it's centered on the Thuba, whereas Hara Kabira is the more intellectual and worldly community coming from Spain.
So the community seems to have thrived. Is this still true? I mean, is it still a thriving community?
Well, the community, yes, you could say that they thrived. They continued. It was a continuing community through the colonial period. They resisted attempts by the Alliance Israélite to take on secular education. Mm-hmm. But they welcomed emissaries from Palestine who introduced modern Hebrew education, secular education in Hebrew. And at that point, I think it was around 1940, they opened up schools which taught secular subjects in Hebrew, which ran parallel with the yeshivot. So that was actually a blessing for the girls of Djerba, because from that point they learned, they became literate. They learned to read and they learned to write. I don't know if you know, but traditionally women don't participate in the synagogue services in Djerba. It's not just like in other traditional Jewish communities or conservative communities where women do participate but are given a separate space from the men. In Djerba, they don't participate at all. And from the time when they began to receive an education and they could read in Hebrew, they started to conduct their own services and their own prayers in the girls' schools. So that was a big advance for women. After Tunisian independence in 1956, and in fact, even between the establishment of the State of Israel and 56, Djerban Jews began to trickle away. And after independence, that became a real mass emigration. And they, those who didn't leave after 56, many of them left after 67, the war, the Arab-Israeli war of 67, and then again after 73. There the reasons for that are complex. They weren't actively forced to leave, but many aspects of Tunisian society and politics, the political situation, made staying uncomfortable and in some instances dangerous.
I think that also occurred in Morocco.
It happened throughout the Arab world. And the exception of Djerba is that so many stayed. And not only did so many stay in numbers, but they kept their communal structures intact. And I can't tell you the exact numbers of the community, but it's roughly estimated to have stayed fairly stable at around between 1,000 and 1,500, 1,000, 1,200, that sort of figure. And it's a community that consists of all generations, that the younger generations choose to stay. I mean, they tend to build houses as an extension of the parental home. And the children are educated in Djerba, and then many of them marry within Djerba or marry from outside but continue to live in Djerba.
And I understand that there's something like 15 synagogues.
I don't know the exact number of active synagogues. In fact, I thought there were more. I thought there were about 20, but I mean, it's easy to say. I've already been in three active synagogues in Hara Kabira, and, you know, they are used. And there are several family synagogues.
Can you tell us about the pilgrimage?
To understand the pilgrimage and the rituals, you need to understand how they conceived of the festival of Lag BaOmer.
Okay.
And anyway, the Ghriba has always been as a holy site. It's always been a site of pilgrimage, but there is a massive pilgrimage, a communal pilgrimage that happens annually on the festival of Lag BaOmer. And as you probably know, the big pilgrimage for Lag BaOmer is in Meron, in the Northern Galilee. And Meron is the tomb of the rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, who was the second century Kabbalist rabbi, who is said to have been the origin of the Zohar, the central portion of the Kabbalah, and which then got passed down in oral tradition until it was eventually written in Spain. But there was one aspect of Zohar, of Kabbalistic teaching, which particularly resonates with the pilgrimage here in Djerba, and that is the concept of the Shekhinah, which is the feminine aspect of God, or variously interpreted as the bride of God, or the feminine aspect of God in the world. So, for example, you will see that exceptionally in Djerba, at the time of the pilgrimage, women dominate. Women enter the synagogue. Women are free to move wherever they like. They can come. They can pray. They have a special section for their own ritual, which is in the grotto, which you may have already seen, in the inner part of the Ghriba, where they go and they light candles. Now, that grotto has its own story. And the story of the grotto is that one day, a strange woman, came to Hara Sghira, and she set up a hut on the outskirts of the village. And nobody knew who she was, and people were a bit afraid of her. They thought she was some sort of witch that dealt in sort of magic. And one day, her hut caught fire, and the villagers saw the flames, but they were afraid to enter because to approach, because they thought maybe she's working one of her spells. Eventually, the flames subsided, and then they approached, and they found the Ghriba. I'm calling her the Ghriba because that's what they called her, the stranger. They found her body totally intact, unharmed by the flames. And they considered this a miracle. And it also itself, it sort of mirrors the death of the rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, who also at the time of his death was surrounded by a burning light that was so strong that his disciples couldn't approach. And again, when they finally approached, when the light subsided, his body was intact and unharmed. So they put the two stories together, and they realized this woman must be something miraculous, something sacred. And so the second legend of the Reba, apart from the one I told you about the Kohanim, is that it was built as a shrine for this Reba, and some say she was actually buried within the grotto. And that's why the grotto has become a special place for women, and they go in and they light candles, and they put eggs there. And the candles, in the heat of the candles, the eggs are supposed to cook, and of course that's supposed to provide them with fertility, and they write notes, and this is supposed to be the answer to their wishes.
Eggs are very important in a lot of traditions in the spring. I mean,
exactly. Yes. Well, this is a time of late spring, isn't it? Yes.
Can you tell us about what you yourself are doing? Because you said you're an ethnomusicologist and you're specializing in Tunisia.
Yes.
I imagine that is it just Tunisia, Tunisian Jews specifically?
No, I've written a lot about Tunisian music generally, different aspects of Tunisian music, but particularly the tradition known as Maalouf, which is the tradition that supposedly came from Al-Andalus with the Muslims and the Jews. And Jews have traditionally had a special place in Tunisian music, and this was common throughout the Arab world, in that music was, particularly playing musical instruments professionally, was a sensitive occupation. It was not considered a respectable occupation traditionally in Islamic society, particularly in Islamic urban society. And Jews were, as the minority, were always called on to do what the majority didn't want to do. And this is part of the explanation, I think, why Jews were so, they really were disproportionately represented in music. And at the turn of the century, when the record industry came to Tunisia, Jewish musicians were particularly quick to exploit this new resource. And they started to sing popular songs and invent and compose popular songs in a regular strophic form, so verse, refrain. Mm-hmm. So the timing could be calculated and could fit onto the very brief sides of the records. And there was a wonderful upsurge of Jewish singers and composers, including women, who sang these popular songs. And of course, we have the recordings now. And I fell in love with this repertoire. And one of the places where this repertoire was sung was at the celebrations at the Reba for the pilgrimage. But it wasn't sung in its original Arabic. This repertory was sung in colloquial Arabic, being a popular repertory. And of course, it was sung for Muslims as well. I mean, the audiences were Muslims, as well as Jews. And it was taken up by musicians and sung at weddings, so it sort of became a generally popular repertoire. It wasn't just a media repertoire. But instead of when they came here, instead of singing just in Arabic, they sang in Hebrew. They transferred the tunes to Hebrew texts, which very often mirrored the Arabic texts in rhyme, if not in meaning. And I became interested in this repertoire, and I've written quite a lot about it. And I actually followed it right up until the early years of the 21st century, when there was an old musician, at that time he was old, called Jacob Shiri. And Jacob Shiri was born in 1912. So his musical career included that golden age of Jewish popular song in the colonial period. Of course, it all really collapsed after that. But he carried on singing these songs, and others in the community did too, including women. And it remained a living memory for really until, I would say, the death of Jacob Shiri. I think he was the last person that really perpetuated that repertory here in Djerba.
It's interesting that they translated them into Hebrew, because everybody spoke the colloquial language. So what prompted them to translate these songs into Hebrew?
they didn't translate them into Hebrew. They composed new Hebrew words for them. And the Hebrew words were particularly appropriate for singing at the Griba. Because remember, this is, after all, a Jewish festival. So they sang in Hebrew, and they sang songs that were sacred or semi-sacred. For instance, they composed songs about the Griba. They created new texts. Very often, they were texts that really, they were about the return to the Promised Land. Because really, if you come back to the Shechina and what she represents redemption and return from exile. So the songs really mirror those themes, and they talk about peace in the land of Israel and the time when, you know, everything will be all right and we will all sit and sing as brothers and everyone will get on with everybody else. So the themes of the songs in Hebrew were very different from the Arabic themes, which is a story in itself, what they were about.
Who comes to the pilgrimage?
Well, this is a really interesting question, and it's the reason I'm here is to find out who still comes. But clearly, the Tunisian Jewish diaspora come. They're the main people who want to come. It really still means something to them. It speaks to their roots. The local people of Djerba, of course, come. And it's particularly an opportunity for women and young girls to come and to mix, because they don't have many opportunities in normal life. You know, this is still a fairly rigorously segregated community. And it's here they all come and they put on their best clothes and they're free to enjoy themselves.
Is there anything else you can tell us that you haven't covered?
I think what I've noticed is it's become more and more an event that has been, in a way, directed or steered by the government. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is to do with security. In 2002, there was a bomb went off, not at the pilgrimage, but it seemed to have been targeted at tourists, and Al-Qaeda claimed responsibility. And most of the people most of the victims who died at that time were German tourists, in fact, because there was a coachload of German tourists at the time. And since then, the security has really been very, very much in focus, as you can see. And you can see all the blockades, the police blockades around the village. But I don't know if you've noticed, but there are police guarding the villages in normal times as well. But I think since independence, I mean, since at least the 1980s, there has been a very conscious effort amongst the Jewish people to acknowledge the protection that they get and the freedom that they have to hold this festival from the government. And you always see nationalist symbols around, like the flags, and sometimes you see portraits of the president in the past or whatever. It's made, you know, it's very clear that the Jews want to present themselves as the loyal citizens that they are. Previously, one of the central points of this festival is the dressing of a menorah, and this is a huge five-tiered candelabrum that's mounted on a chariot. And in the daytime, it becomes covered with shawls. And then when it's completely covered and can't hold another shawl, it used to be transported in a procession down the hill to the village of Hara Sphira, to the main synagogue there. And then prayers were said, etc. And then it was transported back in a procession. And the musicians used to lead this procession. But in recent years, that hasn't happened anymore. I think since 2011, because it's just been considered too dangerous and the security can't cover that.
Thank you. That's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you.
So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSefarad.com. See you next week.